of Food Eaters. Welcome to episode number 80 of the Food Labels Revealed podcast. I'm Mel Weinstein, sometimes called the self-proclaimed prophet of processed foods. Thanks for joining me as I continue to explore the world of ultra-processed foods, the ingredients in those foods, and the relationship to our health. Unlike most podcasts, this one is commercial-free. No annoying sales ads, no ill-timed interruptions, no promotions, of course, except for my book, no requests for your hard-earned cash, only educational and entertaining content to stimulate your brain. Let's get right into it. Today's episode is going to focus on the recent history of food additive regulation. Food additives have been around for hundreds, if not thousands, of years to alter the appearance, taste, and texture of foods, and to provide preservation. Now, sometimes for good, sometimes for bad, as in fraud and counterfeiting. Now, I won't be going in that direction today, but rather I want to talk about the recent history of food additives, namely, what has happened since 1958, a pivotal shift in how food additives were perceived by the federal government. I think this is an appropriate time to visit this subject, given the approaching food revolution that you may have heard me talk about in the last year or so. That is, biological synthesis of food ingredients and components through precision fermentation processes and cell culture research. These new ingredients and foods are rapidly heading our way. How will they be received? Well, regarding additives in general, here are some questions I'll address in the podcast. 1. What happened in 1958 to change how food additives were viewed? 2. What role did the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, play with these new rules? 3. What does GRAS, that's an acronym, G-R-A-S, literally mean, and how is it used today? 4. Can food manufacturers introduce new additives at will? 5. Can food additives get yanked from the food supply, and how does that happen? And finally, 6. The challenging and likely unacceptable way that consumers can protect themselves from potentially harmful food additives. Note to listener, the material I present here may be boring to some, may be difficult to understand, and may have to be re-listened to for full comprehension, but I contend that this information is vital. It's central to understanding how the American food system has radically changed in the last 65 years, and how it might deal with the new onslaught of novel foods and food additives emerging in the next decade. I have covered the topic of food additive regulation a few times in the past, but never to this extent. I admit that the material is not easy to digest. Over the years, I have had to read about it over and over again to be satisfied with a basic understanding of the topic. But in doing so, I have learned some shocking facts about how federal regulation of our food supply works. Maybe you'll feel the same. Here we go. Let's mentally travel back to 1958, a year in which most of my listeners did not exist. The 34th president, Dwight Eisenhower, was in the middle of his term. By the late 50s, the USA had become the premier manufacturer of goods in the world. With the US infrastructure and industrial facilities intact after World War II, the US economy boomed in the following decade. To keep a lid on inflation, the savings interest rates were high. I remember as a kid having a savings account interest of 5%, which was considered normal and really not that great at the time. Today, that interest rate looks really, really good. As other sectors were growing, so too were the food manufacturing companies and fast food industry, who were busy creating new and amazing food products. Frozen foods were coming into their stride. TV dinners became a thing. Big food stores were emerging. And of course, Many of the new foods were never before seen creations based on the burgeoning food science discipline and technological innovations in food production. Here's just one example. I encountered and devoured cereals like Post Sugar Crisp and Alphabets, Kellogg's Fruit Loops, Sugar Frosted Flakes, Sugar Corn Pops, and Sugar Smacks, and Rice Krispies, and then Ralston's Purina Rice Chex, General Mills Trix, and Cocoa Puffs, and Wheaties, to name just a few. It's staggering to the mind to contemplate how many new foods got introduced in the 1950s. But on the other hand, that's also the decade when the number of new food additives started growing rapidly. All these new products needed to stay unspoiled, their taste, smell, and texture unchanged, and in some cases, sufficient nutrients like vitamins and minerals maintained, starting from the point of manufacturing and ending at the point of purchase in a retail store. That was the role of additives. Before getting into the nitty-gritty of how a food additive gets approved for use in our food system, let's first look at a definition of a food additive. This definition has actually changed over the last century, but let's just consider the current legal definition. A food additive is, quote, any substance the intended use of which results or may reasonably be expected to result directly or indirectly in its becoming a component or otherwise affecting the characteristics of a food, end quote. Of course, this definition sounds like a government gobbledygook, so let's unpack it. First, we start with a recognized food. If a substance, synthetic or natural, is intentionally added to that food to alter it in some way, then it is considered an additive. The source of the added substance may be in the production of the food, the processing steps, subsequent treatment, packaging, transportation, or storage. If the substance is added to the food for a specific purpose, such as preservation, then it is referred to as a direct additive and will likely appear on the package label. If the substance winds up in the food as a result of packaging, handling, and storage, then it is referred to as an indirect additive and will probably not appear on the package label. Back in 1958, U.S. congressmen got concerned about the growing number of additives that were finding their way into commercial foods, and they felt that they needed to be approved and more stringently regulated prior to entering the marketplace. As a consequence, Congress passed the Food Additives Amendment of 1958, an extension to the Food, Drugs, and Cosmetics Act of 1938. Up until 1958, food manufacturers could use an additive without government interference unless a health or safety concern arose, at which point the government could investigate and potentially ban the additive if concerns were scientifically validated. That view of additives was an example of innocent until proven guilty. With the 1958 law, the government, primarily through the Food and Drug Administration, could regulate new additives and put them through a meticulous process of approval to protect consumers. Additionally, a well-known corollary of the law, called the Delaney Clause, gave the government the power to pull any food additive that was shown to pose a risk for cancer in either humans or animals. As you can imagine, there was a hue and cry from food ingredient manufacturers about these new burdensome regulations. It could cost them time and money and bog down the process of introducing new foods. Questions arose about grandfathered ingredients, ones that had been used for decades or even hundreds of years, that just by virtue of their long-term use were considered safe for consumption. For example, corn oil, vinegar, baking soda. After the dust had settled, the FDA made some important decisions about how to deal with food additives. They created two groups of substances called GRAS, generally recognized as safe. These substances were not subject to rigorous regulation. First, there were the roughly 100 substances previously deemed safe prior to 1958. Second, there were the listed exceptions, including pesticides, color and flavor additives, animal drugs, and dietary substances. Overall, there were about 2,600 substances added to foods that were deemed generally recognized as safe, that is, GRAS. What about new additives introduced after 1958? Turns out that there were three pathways a food ingredient manufacturer could use to get a new substance into the American marketplace. Let's go over these. Pathway number one. Using the regulatory path, they could petition the FDA to approve the substance as a food additive. To you and I, that sounds very logical, but it's actually the least common pathway. Why, you ask? A manufacturer must obtain pre-market approval before their new substance could be used in foods. Only the FDA can provide that approval. That agency reviews the properties and safety elements of the substance as well as set restrictions on its use. The manufacturer must bear the responsibility of proving the food additive's safety. Here is pathway number two. If the new additive falls within a specific list of exceptions to the definition of a food additive, for example, a pesticide chemical, then it gets a pass. The company must still certify the safety of the substance at the intended levels of use, but the process of approval is much easier than seeking certification for a new additive. Pathway number three. This is the most popular pathway and considered a gigantic loophole in the GRAS category. It's the fastest pathway and does not require pre-approval. So manufacturers can start incorporating the new substance without any approvals by the FDA. Food eaters, this is such a key point that it needs repeating. A new substance can enter our food supply without a rigorous evaluation and approval process by the federal government. When the government established the GRAS category in 1958, they only intended it to apply to substances already in the food system. Due to their long usage, they were considered generally recognized as safe. The interpretation of GRAS has gotten diluted such that the manufacturers have significant control over the approval process. Now that's topsy-turvy. Why has it happened? Early on, the FDA realized that they didn't have the money, personnel, or resources to thoroughly evaluate all the new additives being discovered and manufactured, so they reinterpreted what GRAS meant, and the agency turned into more of a facilitator than a regulator. Note that today, there are roughly 10,000 additives potentially found in foods. I say potentially because some of them manufacturers no longer choose to use. Also, note that, to my knowledge, there is no single resource you can go to find the names, descriptions, uses, and limitations on all of these additives. If you're aware of such a source, let me know. You can get a partial list providing names, uses, and registry numbers by looking up the FDA's, quote, substances added to food, end quote, website. See the show notes for that link. Let's look at a pretend example. Acme Industrial Ingredients comes up with a new bactericide called Bacta X, which will extend the shelf life of many commercial food products. Note, this is a nod to the Roadrunner cartoons featuring Wile E. Coyote, who was always using Acme products to capture the super-fast Roadrunner. Bacta X is not on the exception list for approved food additives. That means Acme must either file a petition for FDA approval or they can claim GRAS status for the new preservative. The Acme executives do not want to spend the money it would take to get full regulatory approval for this new additive. Plus, the process would take a long time given the FDA bureaucracy. Furthermore, the company could not market the new preservative while it was under review. So they decided to petition the FDA through the GRAS notification program. With that action, they can roll out the new product whenever they want. However, the onus is still on the company to show that it would be safe to use Bacta-X in various foods at specified levels. They must do that research. They can use existing scientific studies or conduct studies on their own in-house, or they can hire a consultant company to do the research for them. It takes 6 months to gather this information and data to submit to the FDA. So they collate together the properties of Bacta-X, its safety impacts, what foods it can be used in, the levels of use, and so on and so on. The FDA is petitioned to review the data to obtain GRAS status for the new preservative. At its end, the FDA eventually rules on the request in one of three ways. Number one, it can turn down the request because of insufficient or missing data or failure to meet proper safety guidelines. Or number two, it can put the request on hold pending additional information. Or number three, the FDA states that it has no more questions. Notice that the last option is not the same thing as an approval. It just means that the FDA evaluation team is satisfied with the data provided. So now the Acme executives patiently wait for a reply from the FDA. Eventually they get a letter stating that there are omissions or incomplete information on their application and that additional data is needed. Since Acme is losing money every day that Bacta-X is not marketed, they decide to withdraw their petition for GRAS notification and just sell their new product anyway, without getting a nod from the FDA. That's perfectly legal. Acme does not have to have government approval to sell its product. However, that can be risky for two reasons. Number one, if Acme Industrial Ingredients tries to sell Bacta-X to big food manufacturing companies like Kellogg, their customer might balk at buying it because the product has not been evaluated by the FDA. And number two, if Acme manages to get Bacta-X into commercial foods, but it causes consumers to get sick, Acme could be subject to expensive recalls and lawsuits. If Acme takes the risk and it backfires, then if they want to continue selling Bacta-X, they must go back to square one and submit an application to the FDA for full additive approval. Let's pause for a moment. How many GRAS requests does the FDA evaluate each year? By accident, I came across a website posted by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, which listed all the petitions between 1972 and 1980. The total number was 381 over that 9-year span, or 42 per year. Nowadays, 50 years later, there are a lot more petitions. For example, there are about 60 in 2020. The FDA is required to post each new petition it receives and its status. If you want to get neck deep into the FDA submissions, check out the website mentioned in the show notes, which will take you to the FDA page listing them. Here's an interesting question. Can additives enter our food supply without being subjected to review by the FDA? In April 2014, the Natural Resources Defense Council, known as the NRDC, issued a report concerning the investigations of food ingredient manufacturers that marketed substances not submitted for GRAS review by the FDA. The NRDC is a highly respected nonprofit international environmental advocacy group composed of lawyers, scientists, and other policy experts whose mission is to ensure the rights of people to the air, the water, and the wild, and to prevent special interests from undermining public interests. The NRDC specifically looked at chemicals in the food supply that were not reviewed by the FDA between 1997 and 2014. they identified 398 substances marketed by 163 companies. That's worth repeating. The NRDC identified 398 substances marketed by 163 companies that were not subject to FDA review. This investigation revealed a major flaw in the regulation of our food system. There are some ingredient companies flagrantly defying the right of consumers to a safe food supply. Additionally, if the FDA gives a thumbs down to a GRAS ingredient petition, the manufacturer can withdraw the petition. At that point, the FDA is not required to post at their website the reason why the petition failed or was withdrawn. That information is sealed and not available to the public. The manufacturer can continue to market the unimproved ingredient, and you would never know that by anything you read on a label. By the way, typically 1 in 5 GRAS petitions are either rejected or withdrawn. As an interesting aside, oftentimes chemicals that wind up in dietary supplements are not subjected to a safety review, although they're getting ingested just like food. However, with the exception of vitamins and minerals, supplement bottles must carry a warning label. I looked at a supplement that I've taken in the past called Korean Panax Ginseng, with claims that it supports memory and mental health, boosts energy and focus, and boosts performance. On the label is the following, quote, "These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease," end quote. Check out your own supplements. At least you are told up front that the health aspects of the supplement ingredients have not been evaluated, so you can decide for yourself the level of risk you can tolerate. Although the review process of a new food ingredient seems flawed, the FDA does play a critical role in evaluating the purposes and safe uses of it. The FDA does a critical analysis of the data provided by the ingredient manufacturer and recommends additional testing if necessary. In some cases, if warranted, the FDA can degrass the status of an already approved ingredient. In that case, the manufacturer would have to submit a request for an additive approval, a lengthier and more intensive review by the FDA, and then later obtain pre-market approval. For example, the FDA degrassed 6 synthetic flavoring agents in 2018 because they violated the Delaney Clause. The following chemicals were found to cause cancer in lab animals: benzophenone, noted for its geranium notes, ethyl acrylate, smells like pineapple a little, methyl eugenol, I don't know what that smells like. Myrcene has a balsam odor. Poulagon smells like peppermint. And pyridin smells like dead fish. So these 6 chemicals are gone from the food supply. Now, as a chemist, I sometimes worked with pyridin, and in its concentrated form, it was very toxic. If the pyridin got on your skin or clothes, it's nasty, fishy odor would last a very long time, maybe days, and you would find people avoiding you. Well, food eaters, that's all I have to say about food additives and how they get approved or not approved by our federal government. Now, if the food additive is not involved in interstate transport, then the federal rules governing approval do not apply, and the approval process is left to the states. Because a good deal of information was presented here, I want to summarize the key points. Number 1, the majority of food substances are not subjected to rigorous evaluation by the FDA as food additives. 2, instead, food ingredient manufacturers submit a petition to have the substance evaluated as GRAS, a quicker and simpler process which allows them to avoid pre-market approval. 3, regardless of the evaluation process, it is always the responsibility of a food ingredient manufacturer to prove that an ingredient is safe to consume at the intended levels used in the food. 4. A food ingredient manufacturer has the right to not submit a food ingredient for FDA approval, but it must still guarantee the safety of it in the food supply or face negative consequences. 5. Most ingredient manufacturers will seek GRAS approval because their customers, large food manufacturers, may require it. 6. In this country, food additives and GRAS ingredients are not subject to independent, unbiased reviews, which undermines the validity of test results for safety. And finally, 7. The GRAS process is a huge loophole for food ingredient manufacturers that Congress never intended to provide in 1958 as part of the Food Additives Amendment. Finally, if any of the information provided in this episode is upsetting to you, what can you do about it? Yes, you can reach out to your congressional representatives to try to change the system, but that's the long game. For yourself, more immediately, here's what you can do to protect yourself from the potential hazards of food additives. And I guarantee that 99.9% of people will find this suggestion untenable. Here it is. Simply stop eating processed foods. No additives, no worries. Lastly, I want to again remind listeners of my new book, available at the Amazon website. Fast Food Ingredients Revealed is a guide that pulls the food curtain aside and reveals the industrial ingredients used by McDonald's, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell. A small subset of menu items for each restaurant is broken down into its individual ingredients. The additives are identified and described in a comprehensive glossary in the appendix. A more detailed glimpse at some of the more interesting and surprising additives is included in the text. The reader will get a very good introduction into the abundance of chemicals used in the fast food industry. Furthermore, a unique scoring system created by the author grades each menu item to provide an assessment of the degree of industrialization of each food item examined. The score roughly reveals how far from natural the food item has been altered. To order the book in either Kindle or paperback format, simply go to Amazon and type my name, Mel Weinstein, or the title of the book, Fast Food Ingredients Revealed, in the search engine. Well, that's it for today, food eaters. Thanks to all of you for tuning in. If you know others who would enjoy this podcast, please share this episode by sending a link, by text, or by sharing it to your social media pages. If you have a moment, I'd greatly appreciate a 5-star rating at Apple or the iTunes Store. If you don't have a streaming device, you can find all the episodes of Food Labels Revealed and their show notes at the hosting website called Podbean. That's at www.podbean.com or just by Googling Food Labels Revealed. If you want to shoot me a message, I can be reached at foodlabelsrevealed@gmail.com. Until later, remember this. If you want to eat well and keep yourself healthy, eat food mainly from natural plants, not manufacturing plants. The outro music piece is called My Lonely Journey, composed by Alec Zaveza.